Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk on right intention and right thinking. This talk includes Sangha Q&A and discussion and was recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on November 19, 2016. This talk concludes with Metta Intentional Meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
So this morning's talk is on right intention. And if you read the article, I'm starting about halfway through. The lead into this in the background is the importance of recognizing how the Eightfold Path frames our practice, and in particular how right intention is so important to maintain that throughout our practice, because that's really what guides our moment-by-moment experience of our own life. It took Siddhartha Gautama approximately 6 years of intense study and practice with some of the most advanced teachers of his time to understand that awakening was not a process of additional acquisition of spiritual experience or intellectual knowledge. And that was even common during the Buddha's time. That's why people left their families and their home, why the Buddha left the palace and went seeking to acquire so-called spiritual knowledge. And through his arduous practice, he realized that it wasn't about acquiring some type of esoteric or mystical knowledge. It was about developing a very practical way of living a human life as our life occurs. Through his severe ascetic practices, he developed what he described as a middle way between extreme views rooted in ignorance. He knew that accommodating the prevailing dharmas of his time would only lead to more confusion and suffering, as they were rooted in ignorance of a very specific ignorance. It wasn't that the teachings were ignorant teachings, they were simply ignorant of Four Noble Truths. From great frustration arising from the physical and emotional results of his ineffective search, Siddhartha generated the intention, the right intention, to abandon all impermanent and ignorant views and ideas he had acquired. With right intention, he sat, and so after all these 6 years of study, very severe ascetic practices. You heard the story. The Buddha was walking down the road one day, and because of his poor health brought on by his own practice, he passed out and rolled down a little hill into a river and nearly drowned. And Sujata, an 11 or 12-year-old girl, pulled him out of the river and nursed him back to health. And as he started regaining his health, he realized that those severe practices, the extreme asceticism, was a view that drove him towards that practice, and that was an extreme view. And since for the first 29 years of his life, he lived in a palace and had every one of his sensory and sensual desires was fulfilled, and he found that lacking. That's how he developed his middle way between the extreme view of constant sensory indulgence and the other extreme of constant self-denial. And both of those are prevalent today in different practices. Even the ascetic practice of a very bare Dhamma practice is a form of asceticism. You're cutting too much out of your life. It's not a middle way. During meditation, so the Buddha, to finish the story, the Buddha, out of this frustration of all the work that he did in, the intense study and the intense asceticism, finding that he was nowhere in his search, he was right where he was when he began, except he had acquired an understanding of these extreme views not being helpful, decided that I am going to sit here in meditation until I gain complete understanding. That was the generation of right intention, the beginning of right intention for the Buddha. During meditation, as samadhi or non-distraction deepened, Siddhartha clearly experienced the results of wrong view arising from ignorance. He gained true insight into dukkha or suffering. As a direct result of his non-distracted mind state, Siddhartha was able to refine his thinking. He understood that the solution to the problem of dukkha, of disappointment, confusion, and suffering, was not to be found with yet another spiritual philosophy focused on external expressions of concepts arising from acquired temporary views. He also now understood that these hardened acquired views were rooted in ignorance and that freedom from confusion and suffering required abandoning all of those views. From his profound understanding and unbound compassion, he taught that his Dhamma was as unique and precious as a rare jewel. He consistently avoided comparison or reconciliation to prevalent and widely accepted dharmas. In fact, a lot of his teachings, especially on karma and rebirth, were directly contradictory to what was presented as the truth during his time. Even though he used the terms, and he taught karma and rebirth, he taught them in completely realistic ways that was often contradictory to the common application of those. Right intention is occasionally translated to mean right thinking. Being mindful of the right intention to abandon all craving and clinging inclines the mind to continually consider, rather than ignore, clinging the ego personality to objects, views, and ideas. I think that's clear to everyone except maybe Eric. Is it? Is that clear? So I should qualify this a little bit. Right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon all craving and clinging that arises from within ourselves. And that's what the broader framework helps us to understand. So just to give a little background to what I'm talking about. The Buddha taught four noble truths. He taught how to develop understanding of dukkha and release from clinging, how to practice and develop the Eightfold Path. In his own words, these are the Buddha's words, I teach the understanding of dukkha and the cessation of dukkha, nothing more. The Eightfold Path is a path that develops a refined way of thinking, free of the demands of an ego personality, for constant distraction and constant establishment of the ego in every thought that occurs. The Buddha teaches through dependent origination that the belief in anatta as a self is rooted in ignorance that results in the confusion and suffering known as dukkha. So what that means is we simply don't understand what we are in relation to this impermanent world and how we are always in a constant process of becoming, rather than establishing a stagnant and permanent ego personality. This is what I am. And using those views that arise from this is what I am creates a constant discursive way of thinking in our own minds. We confuse ourselves simply by insisting that this permanent thing that I am right now is who I am and I'll be this forever, rather than understanding that we're in a process of constantly understanding who we are in relation to the world. And as we develop the suppleness and the spaciousness in our own minds, then our minds are able to accommodate what's occurring rather than obscure it by trying to fix it into a view that's not based in reality. Is that clear? Or did I make it more confusing by what I just said? Our views are wrong views. First factor of the Eightfold Path is a right view in relation to the Four Noble Truths. So that implies that we are here to develop understanding of these four truths. Right intention is being mindful of the ego personality's need to constantly establish itself in every object, event, view, and idea. Anatta refuses to have a thought that is not self-referential and does not continue to establish itself. This is very subtle, and understanding this one point is the refined thinking that the Buddha achieved. For those who want to actually develop understanding and release through the Buddha's Dhamma, right intention shows that one must be willing to recognize and abandon the demands of an ego personality's insistence on accommodating the Buddha's teachings to allow for further establishment of anatta. In other words, we're presented these simple and direct teachings that the Buddha gave 2,600 years ago and are just as relevant today as they were when first presented. But as we start developing an understanding of these, if we're filtering it through that view that's rooted in ignorance of these truths, we're always going to accommodate and adapt the Buddha's teachings to fit our views rather than use the teachings to change our views. And that's been very common for 2,600 years. And again, the reason why the Buddha taught this Eightfold Path and not just meditation is because he recognized the common human problem of conditioned thinking or confirmation bias. We needed something to act as a framework so that we can change our view. And again, that's why the Eightfold Path was taught. Developing understanding requires the refinement of thought. The refinement of thought is developed with shamatha vipassana meditation within the framework of the Eightfold Path. The process of refining thought is antagonistic to anatta as anatta seeks to establish itself in every thought that occurs. This constant vigilance to see itself in all thoughts is the constant distraction arising from clinging mind. In other words, until we start developing the Dhamma and create some spaciousness in our thoughts, every thought that we have has some component of self-reference in it. We see things as we like this, we don't like it, I want more of this, I want less of this. And as soon as we start that process going in our minds, we start creating what everybody calls a monkey mind. We create distraction by our own self-referential needs. Rather than being free of those needs, and then whatever occurs, we are able to experience our life dispassionately with great mindfulness. We're able to stay present with our life as our life unfolds. And that's really the big secret to a life of lasting peace and happiness. We're no longer going through life picking and choosing what we like and what we don't like, because as the Buddha taught when he first explained the Eightfold Path, we have no control over anything that occurs in our life. What we do have control over is the way we experience that, and that's what occurs in our thinking. And if our thinking is rooted in right thinking, then our experience is free of stress. Let me continue. Anatta refuses to abandon any container for itself. In other words, anything that we're using to describe ourselves, that now is part of me, and I'm not letting it go. For itself, including the conceptual containers of accommodated Buddhism. As all experiences are impermanent, the continual attempt at maintaining anatta results in constant tension and continual distraction. This constant vigilance of anatta maintains the inherent attachment to the disappointing nature of experience. This constant vigilance of anatta is the distraction of dukkha that is maintained in the constant demand and constant demands for self-referential experiences. The deep concentration developed through shamatha vipassana meditation directly interrupts clinging mind's desire to remain distracted by interrupting clinging one thought to the next. That's what many people experience in beginning meditation as spaciousness. My mind feels more spacious. Well, it is, because you're not clinging one thought immediately with the next. There's a little space in between. That's also another word for deepening concentration. We're no longer distracted by our own thinking. Once clearly seen, clinging can be quickly abandoned. This is true and useful insight. I think I'm going to stop right there. There's a little bit more to the article, because that last line points to what this whole thing is about, gaining insight into our own insistence on maintaining these self-referential views that prop up an ego personality where it can't be propped up. Once we learn to let go of these views, and the question often comes up, well, what happens to me when I let go of all these self-referential views? It comes up nearly every class when I talk about this. Because that feels like annihilation. It feels like our views define ourselves. And when we are defining our life through those views, and then we realize the ramifications of this teaching means letting go of all those views, well, what happens to me? What happens to you is you've let go of all views rooted in ignorance. And now you're free to acquire the first factor of the Eightfold Path. You're free to acquire right view. But we first have to let go, and we first have to recognize and abandon these views that are contradictory and creating stress in our lives before we can develop right view. It's a one-to-one equation. We cannot maintain both qualities of mind without creating additional stress in our lives. And I know people that do that. In fact, we probably all do it to some extent when we begin practice, that we're coming up against our old views that we're recognizing no longer serve us well, but they're entrenched, and we start creating this way of looking at the world that is more settled than right view, and that even creates its own kind of tension, doesn't it? Because these are difficult things to let go of when we're using them to define ourselves, and it does feel like annihilation. So one of the reasons why I always say it, I think every class I've ever taught, maybe not everyone, is we need to be very gentle with ourselves. And this is the reason why, because we're coming up against every one of the views that we've created ourselves and that were imposed on us by the environment that we live in, the world we live in. And that's a very difficult and sometimes very fearful thing to do. Again, because it feels like annihilation. What we gain as we go through this process and we're able to recognize what we're doing is the ability to recognize the potential that each moment holds then. And we can recognize that each moment holds the potential to continue to incline our minds through refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, to incline our minds towards awakening, towards full human maturity, or to continue. You know, the root of ignorant behavior is we need to ignore something. We would ignore that which would deliver us from confusion, delusion, and ongoing suffering. And that's, again, that's part of the conditioned mind. Conditioned mind lives on ignorance. And it's a self-imposed and self-developed type of ignorance. The Buddha recognized that again. When he first awakened, he awakened to the understanding that it is from ignorance of four noble truths through 12 observable causative links that lead to all manner of suffering. That's what dependent origination states. And in his very first teaching, he then presented the four noble truths to describe the result of a misunderstanding of who we are in relation to the world. And basically, that's all that he taught. But he taught that for 45 years through thousands of different suttas to suit individual situations and applications. So that's the talk. Before we go around the room, is there any questions specific to the talk? No? We're good? So I'd like to hear how your practice is going. And again, if any questions come up, just let me know. Eric, how was your meditation this morning?
It was very good, thanks.
And were you able to maintain the method?
Yeah, my brain is going pretty fast, so.
Yeah, everybody.
But I was able to bring it back.
Yeah, and that's the basic practice. Recognize when you're caught up in your thoughts, come back to the sensation of breathing. And if you remember that, then you won't get frustrated with your meditation practice. And don't try to do too much too fast. So I recommend, if you're going to continue, to start with short periods of meditation, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes. And if you can do that consistently and twice a day and be part of our Sangha, pretty soon you have an effective meditation practice. And as you develop your practice and your concentration deepens, you're able to integrate the other factors of the Eightfold Path. And that's what we'll talk about in class. Have you been to the meditation website?
Yes.
So there's articles and talks. There's a recording of this meditation on the website you can download and listen to. Great. So good. Welcome to our Sangha. Kevin, how about you? How's your meditation practice going?
Good. The practice is going well. It's been pretty consistent in the mornings, but I'm just, I haven't been to the Sangha, but really grateful to be here and grateful for everybody. And the talk was, I enjoy this talk because, I guess we're coming through seasonal change here in the winter, sort of a season for inner work.
Yeah.
The winter is, that's what it's for.
Yep.
So I'm excited about you teaching the Truth of Happiness course again. And
a couple of weeks.
It's those wisdom factors that keep coming up, and those are sort of the entry point. We've done the course, I've done the course, everybody's probably done the course, but, you used to think like, oh, well, I've done the course, but you do the course again, and you're going to do the course again, and you're going to do it again, and I'm going to do it again my whole life. I'm going to do that 10-week course, hopefully a lot of times, but, that's sort of that profound right view that is the next, and then the next time is more profound right view, and more profound right view, and that's what you take into your life, those wisdom factors, and inclining the mind toward awakening or towards what we're trying to release. So, really grateful for you and your teachings, and thank you.
Thank you. Glad you're here. Jen.
Hi. Practice is going good. I've been noticing lately that I've changed in certain ways that are nice to recognize. That, I used to get to work late, 2 or 3 days a week for 14 years. The same place that I would go to every week, every day, for 15 years. And now I don't get to work late anymore. And I think it's because I'm I have to leave by 6:30 if I want to get to work on time. And all this time it's been oh no, it only takes an hour to get to work. I can leave at 6:40. And somehow, that inner voice that is wrong would get more weight. My conditioned mind would get more weight than reality.
Yeah.
What's really happening. And just little things like that I've noticed that is interesting. I do also recognize that I'm still ignoring blatant truths that I wish I wasn't, but at least, I see that. I recognize that. That's it. So that's kind of cool.
It's great. Thank you for saying that. That's another practical application of the Dhamma. You recognize that that conditioned thinking that kept saying 6:40 was okay,
yeah.
Just because you're doing it, there's a part of you that knows that that's not okay. It's not true. But because it's conditioned, you keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And you almost feel like you can't not do it. Conditioned thinking.
Yeah, so
And that's how it works. And that's, again, that's the practical application. You're able to recognize it. And once you recognize it, you simply let it go. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to figure out where it came from, where did it start, you know. Just let it go. So, thank you. Judy, good to see you.
Good to be here, John. practice is going well. And I just continue to... This whole practice continues to help me in my life with... Because, you know, there's always stress and there's been some. And so I find myself still, though, when something happens, and something happened the other night, and like my body shakes, and I mentally go through all the what ifs, all the different scenarios of what could happen, and I still feel that if I do that, I'm kind of in some way prepared for any of them to happen. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden I realize, and that starts to repeat, and, you know, and I could like make myself crazy. So, but I see that like quickly, and I take a deep breath and I think, this is nuts. You don't know what's going to happen. Whatever happens, you'll deal with it. It's okay. This is a waste of time and energy. And so, and I was really able to get myself extricated from that place much faster than I used to. And also I noticed physically, because I would always get low back, right? It would always be like everything I'm thinking would manifest physically there. And I thought, oh, I'm going to wake up and I'm going to have it. And I didn't. And I thought, wow, this is terrific. And like, I was good, you know. And I just chalk it all up to this practice and your teachings. And they've just helped me in that way. They continue to help me in that way.
Yeah.
There's stress.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, thank you.
I hate feeling that way, so this has really helped me to to not feel that way and get out of it. So significant.
It really is, isn't it? I mean, and again, it's just a practical example of how it works. That's how it's supposed to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a path to developing lasting peace and happiness in our lives, not just an escape from stress and a complete understanding of it, so that we can let go of our own contributions to it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Eva, good to see you this morning.
John,
we've missed you.
I've missed everyone. This practice and being among the members of the Sangha is a very vital thing in my life. I find that I have a calm place that I didn't have before, and I don't fight to get it. It's there. I open up to it, and the things that I've been experiencing, I won't say enjoy, but in a way, I've learned things about myself that, I don't know, were not there before. I definitely believe that they were not there before, but there's just, you know, a place to go and tools to use and something to work with that really is invisible, but it's so powerful, and I feel so grateful to be here and happy to be with everyone.
Thank you. That what you said is so significant. You become, as we let go of these limiting self-referential views that feel like this is all we are, and it feels like annihilation to let go of them, we become more of what we are, don't we? We become more significant to our own selves. We become more significant in relation to our own lives by simply letting go of those self-limiting views. Really remarkable. Good. Glad you're here this morning. Mary, welcome. It's good to see you this morning. How are you?
Things are going well. My practice goes well. I find myself sometimes, slipping into discursive thinking and this sort of thing, and I'm able to nip it in the bud before it gets rolling downhill too fast.
Yeah.
And you know, you need to keep all these things in mind, that it's not what happens. I mean, things are going to happen, but you have to modify how you react to them.
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. There's the good word. I don't use it often, but ajita. You know. Thank you, Mary. Glad you're here. Debbie, good to see you this morning.
Good
how are
to
you?
See you and everyone, John. So, I'm really good and consistent about my morning practice. Doesn't mean that I'm having a huge amount of. I'm getting better at bringing my mind back. I always still struggle with my mind going. Mm-hmm. I'm not really able to do the second meditation very often, sometimes a couple times a week. But I feel like this talk was helpful. I finally got on your newsletter, so I read some of it ahead of time. First for me.
Yeah, good.
That was good. And, you know, I guess for me, when you talk about annihilation, it's like, I think that's a big thing for me because I think where I came from in terms of a big family and struggling to survive kind of thing, that I have a scarcity thing or something, so it's like my condition thinking, it's always like about me. I have to make sure I'm going to survive. I have to voice my opinion. I have to, you know, I have to represent myself or advocate for myself all the time. So it's so realizing that more and more that I don't need to do that and that there's a lot of peace in not doing it.
Yeah, there's a lot.
And to kind of back, and it's really helpful in my relationship. Back off and realize that even if I don't get my way or not like I want it. It can be good. And I don't always have to be hyper vigilant to taking care of myself. That's there because of where I came from. I understand that, you know, and I can be gentle because of that. But to just take more and more risks about kind of letting go of that need to, you know, be right or whatever it is.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's such great freedom in that. When we cease the need to continually establish our self-referential ego self in a permanent way, then everything opens up. And we don't get caught up in that hypervigilance because our mind isn't going there anymore. We simply accept that we're in an ongoing process, and here we are. This is what's occurring. It doesn't need to be any different because it can't be any different. You know, and then if there's things in our lives that we need to change, we make changes.
Right.
It's just that simple.
It's kind of learning that there's some safety in it, but I don't think I've got that totally yet. Like, the hypervigilance will take time to let go of.
It does, and all the more reason that we need to be gentle with ourselves. Again, because we're letting go of these hardened views. We're letting go of everything we think that we are. And once we let go of those things, we can be what the Buddha described as an awakened human being, maintaining a mind of equanimity, a mind of calm. And we are, as we deepen our concentration, we're able to maintain that and recognize it even more. So, thank you for being here. Glad you brought that up. Lorna, good morning.
Good morning. I've had a week, I think I've been over-trying. The talk today was on right intention. I think I've got the right intention that I'm here. I want to learn the teachings, the beautiful vehicle path. I've got the right intention in that sense. I go about it the wrong way, in as much as I, you know, when you can overanalyze your mind and overthink things.
Yep.
And when you think about the purpose, well, personally, my purpose of being here is to have an emptier mind so that I can appreciate the little things in life that I'm missing now because I'm. My mind's caught up in something else, therefore I'm missing the beauty of my life in a lot of ways, in some ways. And when you overanalyze this, you get into this pattern of overanalyzing it and trying to work it out. You end up with a more, you know, distracted mind. And I've had a week sort of going down the wrong path in that sense. So I need to just back off, relax, don't try so hard, be gentle with myself, and just hold the basics in mind, you know, and just and you just sort of gave a can't control life anyway. You know, you can't do it. And you can't do it. But we keep on trying, you know. And it's that understanding that you can't control life. And I need to take that away and think about it.
Yeah, thank you. The only thing that we can control, getting back to the Vitakasatthana Sutta that I taught about 6 weeks ago, there's a talk on the website. What the Buddha is saying is the only thing that we can control in life is our thinking and the way we view the world. That's it. And of course, if you think about that, of course it's true. There's really, we don't have any control over what the Buddha taught. We don't have any control over birth, sickness, aging, and death. We don't have any control over the associations that we create that might bring us disappointment or create more stress by holding on to things. The only thing we can do, really, is let go. Let go of all these self-referential views. Of course, it gets back to what Debbie was talking about, what we talk a lot about. It feels like annihilation. But all that we're letting go of is what? An idea of who we think we are. And it's a wrong idea. It's just another way of putting it. You know? So we're not letting go of anything that has any substance. In fact, it's hanging on to something that is insubstantial and our minds claiming it as substantial that creates all the problems. We're just letting go of an idea. Let go of the idea. And then you're free to have another idea or another view, meaning right view. So, what a great class.
So there was one thing you said there. You said the only thing we can control is our own thinking. And I know what you meant by that. But I understand what you meant. I just think about how when I was first starting out, being a person that is, you know, I would have labeled as a control freak, like that likes to control things or wants to control things. You know, somebody saying to me, I can only control my own thinking, turned me into, now I'm going to try to control this. And so I just wanted to revisit that phrase and ask you how you might rephrase it, because I know you don't mean you
yes.
can't make your thoughts stop happening. Because you always say, you know, we're human beings, you know, our minds,
yep.
we should have thoughts.
Yes.
So.
They're always flowing.
Right.
The point is to not be distracted by our thoughts.
Right.
So, and then getting back to that Vitakasatthana Sutta, there's a line in there towards the end of the sutta where the Buddha says we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. And so that's what I'm talking about control. It doesn't mean another hypervigilance on our thoughts. It means that we've developed a well-concentrated mind that's no longer distracted, meaning thinking thoughts that we don't want to think, that aren't helpful. We're just driven to those thoughts through this monkey mind, this reaction to things. And we have a framework now, an Eightfold Path, for developing a framework for how to see life correctly. That's thinking things, seeing things as they really are, rather than reacting to them and going down into a whole bunch of different scenarios. You were talking about what might happen. We get caught up in that. And we think that that's a safe mind to have, going over all the scenarios that might take place in the next moment or tomorrow or next year. Yeah, and every time we think like that, I mean, you have to look at this closely, but there's always a you in there that is threatened. And that's what drives your thinking to get that distracted. Gaining control of our thinking, our minds simply don't go there. Something occurs, and if it requires a rational response in this moment, I keep going back to this. I gave a talk on dependent origination at our, I think, the first retreat, maybe the second retreat, a couple years ago, and somebody started getting the feel of what this really means, and he put his hand up, because the implication was that we should have no response, no reaction, no thoughts about what's occurring, and that's an extreme view. So his question was, what happens if you're standing on a train tracks and a train's coming at you? Meaning, his thinking was, well, since there's no me, that I just, you know, nothing's going to happen. The answer is you take two steps to the left, get out of the way. We don't become complete fools. We learn how to think. We learn how to think in a critical way.
And see things clearly.
We see things clearly. Now it's time to move this way. It's not preservation of an ego self. It's sensible to keep the body alive. That's all. And those are another, just, you know, a kind of an extreme example. But what I mean by gaining control of our 2 weeks ago, it's an aspect of restraint too. We recognize that simply because something's occurring out there, I don't have to take it in as me.
Right.
I don't have to create an identity. I can guard. That's what it means by practicing restraint, mm-hmm. guarding my sense gates. This is not me. I don't have to attach myself. I don't have to define myself by it. And we can do that with everything that occurs if we're gently vigilant with our thinking, if we have the right frame of reference. Another example would be we get into a situation where an argument seems to come up. This is the next thing that's going to happen. We're going to be arguing with this person. Well, I want to maintain my calm and equanimous mind. I don't want to argue. So I let my own self-referential views just settle. I don't have to express myself here. I don't have to put myself forth. And that allows me, when I'm not concerned about presenting a competing view towards someone, then I'm able to be mindfully present with them. And it's a remarkable thing. I was probably arguing with the doctor the minute I was born. That's the way I was. It's too cold in here. Turn the lights down. Where were you, Mom? That was my nature. As I started developing the Dhamma, I stopped the need to express who I am all the time. And it literally changed my life. And I remember clearly the first few times I tried it out and it hurt. And it was fearful. But I didn't get caught up in an argument. And I was able to stay present and listen to someone else and hear where they're really coming from rather than immediately take a stance, well, I got to defend myself here. This person's challenging me. Well, so what? You can challenge me. It's not going to change me at all.
I'm going to say this, I'm going to say that, and you don't even hear what they're saying.
Yeah, I finally learned what that phrase sticks and stones means. It took a long time. You know, it makes sense when you first hear it, but if you're always defending yourself, it means you think those sticks and stones can have a real effect on you. They can't. If I have a well-controlled mind, then nothing can shake it. You know, that's the picture of the Buddha. That's a calm mind. Nothing's happening here, you know, no matter what you do. When you read the stories of the legend of the Buddha's awakening during his meditation, they use the metaphor of the malevolent god Mara, who's coming after the Buddha with all these different things. Well, these are just his mind states that are coming up. These self-referential, and every one of them came up, the Buddha says, ah, that's not me. That's impermanent. Let it go. And a few other things came up. And over the course of that long meditation period, the Buddha's awakening, he recognized every self-referential mind state that he had, causing disturbance in his mind. He recognized them as impermanent and that there was no self in them. He let them go. And after he did this the legend is 1 day to 40 days, somewhere in the middle is probably accurate, he awakened. Nothing happened when he awakened outwardly, but inwardly he understood. He understood the nature of his own contribution to stress. And as far as we know, he never did that again. He let it go. And then, thankfully for all of us, he decided, well, I'm going to teach others how to do it. And here we are. This is really the most remarkable thing. 2,600 years after these teachings were first given, here we are talking about the same teachings. That to me is, and the retreat in a couple weeks is on refuge. That's a true refuge. Isn't it remarkable? And they're useful teachings. It's not something that's stuck in esoterica or mysticism. There's nothing we have to do, meaning rituals or other practices. The only thing we got to do is meditate and develop an understanding of four truths. It's easy.
I like to think about the word practical comes from the word practice. You know, kind of simple. But it's like what we practice becomes practical in our lives.
Yeah.
This is the most practical thing that I've been fortunate to experience or find. So.
Yeah, me too. And it points to right intention. That right intention to recognize and abandon craving, if we hold that in mind, that guides our practice. Our practice won't get distracted or diluted or going into a different direction. What's my intention in each moment? I want to find out what I'm craving for and what I'm clinging to here. And if I recognize it, then I can let it go. And eventually you get to the point where you don't need anything. And then everything is available to you, isn't it? Because you're not dragging a whole bunch of stuff around that you don't need. It's just here. That phrase, life is a banquet, don't leave the table hungry. Instead of life is a banquet, take only what you need. Why drag all that other stuff around with you? Okay, that's a good class. Any other questions or comments about today's class? A few quick announcements. The Donna dinner is Tuesday. Info on the website, but please come and bring your friends. Starts at 6, ends at 8. If anybody else can help set up, if you can, you can just show up around, you know, quarter after 5 or 5:30. I think we could use just a, you know, one or two more people to help, if that's possible. If you can't, just get there around 6. If you can, bring a dish to share or a practical gift, and there's on the website there's some suggestions for that. I think I bought enough soda and water, I think, so if anybody was thinking of that, I mean, you can still bring it, but I don't think we need any more. So that's the Donna dinner. December 4th on a Sunday is our next one-day retreat right here. The topic is refuge, and there's some info on the website about that. Starts about 10, ends around 3. And the week after that, starting December 6th, and that same Saturday, we're going to begin the Truth of Happiness course again. So the Tuesday and Saturday course each week will be the same lesson, so that if you happen to miss one, we can make it up on the next Saturday. And I think that's it. Deb?
Last year, you folks did a retreat in the spring, I think.
Yes.
Will you do that again this year?
Yes, and the dates, I don't have the registration or really any much other information, except it'll be at the same place, the Wan Dharma Center. And
where is that?
It's in a town called Claverack. They, the locals say Clawrack, if you ever
it's
say
in New York.
Yep. Do you know where the town of Hudson is?
Yes.
It's just outside of Hudson, which is a great little town. And I think the dates are on the website right now on the Wisdom 1.0 Retreat Talk page, but I think it's like May. It's mid-May, from a Thursday to a Sunday. I think begins on the 11th or something like that. And we actually are going to have two retreats, the next one next year, and we're going to have a fall retreat in the same place in October. So, I'll probably set up the registration and make an announcement right after the first of the year for that. So, thank you for asking that question. It's a great place to spend the retreat. excuse me. Any other questions? Okay. Let's finish with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us on the path towards full human maturity and an expression of how one lives their lives as awakened. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you
for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.